Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While novelist Stuart Onan is known for his fiction like Snow Angels, A Prayer for the Dying, or Last Night at the Lobster, the latter set during a final shift at a closing Red Lobster restaurant, Onan has never shied away from nonfiction. He's also the author of the acclaimed The Circus Fire, a detailed retelling of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Big Top Fire in Hartford, Connecticut, back in 1944. For his most recent novel, he's created a fictional retelling of the final years of a real and well-documented life. In his book, West of Sunset, Onan revisits the final years of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Now, most of us, when we think of about this celebrated writer, we think of a flame that fired brightly in the 1920s, then flickered out. But while we know the end is coming, those final years, writing for Hollywood in pre-war Los Angeles, don't read so bad. True, Zelda has been institutionalized back east, but Fitzgerald is script doctoring for MGM, along with many of his East Coast pals like Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley, doing similarly. He's working on The Last Tycoon, and he finds love from an English expatriate gossip columnist named Sheila Graham. What West of Sunset does best, though, is recreate that pre-war golden age in Hollywood, when L.A. was still a small company town and when people made movies, not corporations. It's a really wonderful retelling of the final years of F. Scott Fitzgerald, West of Sunset. Stuart Onan is my guest today. Stuart Onan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
In your book, West of Sunset, you tackle the last few years of F. Scott Fitzgerald's life. He's back in Hollywood. Zelda's been institutionalized. And really, it's sort of a sad end. We traditionally think of this as a sad end to this amazing talent's life. What interests you in writing about those last years?
Because I didn't know how it felt for him, those last few years. There's not a whole lot of documentation on it. So I wanted to sort of like get there and inhabit him and be there and see how it really felt for him. That's what I love about fiction, making that jump into somebody else. And I found that it wasn't such a sad end. You know, he goes out there and he falls in love with his wonderful woman, Sheila Graham, and I think it revives him. You know, he regains that romantic view of the world.
Now, you know, when you're writing a novel about real people, I'm interested in how much you feel like you need to know about what his life was really like and what you really don't want to know so that you can make a novel out of it.
I want to know as much as possible. I'm one of those people that's really research heavy. I love doing the research. My wife says I just write the novel so I can do the research, which is partly true, I think. So I got to reread everything that he wrote. I mean, the novels, the stories, the letters, the little nonfiction pieces, everything Zelda wrote, all the great L.A. novels of that time, like John Fonte's Ask the Dust, Horace McCoy's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And, of course, you know, Raymond Chandler sort of looms over this book in a weird way. But I want to know everything, because then I can be selective. And then I can say, what was really important? What's really important about Fitzgerald? And the strange thing here is the really important thing about Fitzgerald in Hollywood is not that he dies. It's that he finds a way to live again.
From your account, it sounds like he got his life back together somewhat.
In a big way. Remember, I mean, he has that crack up in 34, 35, 36 when he's down in North Carolina hanging around the asylum hoping that Zelda's going to get better. And he's in debt. He's about $30,000 in debt to his agents, and there's no way to get out of that hole except to go out to Hollywood. So for years of sitting there in North Carolina being unproductive and drunk and in very poor health, he goes out to Hollywood where people know him. He lives at the Garden of Allen, and the people around him are the friends he had in New York back in the 20s. They know how good he is. They know what a great writer he is. They respect him, even though he's broke, and of course he's drunk a little bit. Dorothy Parker is out there, and Robert Benchley, and Ogden Nash, and Donald Ogden Stewart. Humphrey Bogart lives in the same little complex there. And he goes and works at MGM, which is the prestigious studio at that time. On the same hallway at MGM, there's Aldous Huxley, James M. Cain, Dorothy Parker, and the new kid, Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And some of the nicest section of the novel is this repartee that you use when they're all getting together at the Garden of Allah Hotel, which is a real hotel. It was, a house at one point and became a sort of a series of bungalows that did host these crazy Hollywood parties. And you managed to capture this idea that exists about Hollywood in this pre-war day of sort of being, it's a big city, but it's still a small town.
Yeah, it hasn't really sprawled yet. And remember, it's a very small world there. I mean, the people that went from New York to Hollywood, that's really the Algonquin Roundtable there.
Right.
It's a very small world. Joan Crawford once got to write for him there, and, you know, and Bogart is his next-door neighbor, and, you know, so he recommends him to people in Hollywood. Nathaniel West is out there, and Scott's a great friend of his as well. The best thing for me was Stephen King says, a book takes you away. And I think that works when you're writing, too. A book takes you somewhere, and I wanted to go to the Garden of Allah and hang out there at the parties under the palm trees and the stars and the dancing. And now, I wanted to go out to the Coconut Grove and be dancing there to the big... And I found some CDs that are actually broadcast from the Coconut Grove of that time.
Huh.
So I was playing them while I'm writing the book there. It just to be transported to that place. It's one of the most romantic places, I think, in American history. It's legendary. You know, and to be able to see it through our greatest romantic's eyes, you know, as he's falling in love, it's, you know, it's wonderful.
What makes this particular period so romantic for you?
Well, again, it's L.A. has yet to be sort of, you know, overrun and smog-ridden. It's still this beautiful garden spot. It's kind of a secret in a way, I think. You know, and of course, the glamour of the studio system at the time there. You know, the bungalows that, you know, there's Clark Gable's bungalow and Joan Crawford's bungalow, and they walk into the commissary, and there's Myrna Loy and Judy Garland and Elizabeth Taylor, who's 9 years old. You know, and all the great directors are there. It's just before the Second World War, so there's a great German emigre community, too. So Thomas Mann has moved out there, and Bertolt Brecht and Erich Maria Remarque, you know, and the whole sort of the brain trust of, you know, the former Weimar Germany there. It's just a very fraught time, I think. You know, Hemingway comes to town stumping for the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War. Everything is happening. Everything is sort of, like, bursting. You know, 1937 through about 1940.
Yeah. You said you wanted to read as much research as you could. Sheila Graham, who Fitzgerald falls in love with while he's out there at this particular time, was a gossip columnist who wrote extensively, I guess, pretty much about their relationship. Did you learn much about Fitzgerald through her accounts?
I learned a lot about him, but I also learned a lot about her. She's a fascinating woman. She made it sort of a cottage industry. She wrote at least 4 books about their time together. Well, I'm going to say one every about 8 years. There was Beloved Infidel and College of One and The Real Scott Fitzgerald and The Garden of Allah. And in each book, her stories grow and change. It's really fascinating as a fiction writer to see her memoir, you know, take on new perspectives as, I think, as the sort of the mores of the times change. They get more and more salacious.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's really, really funny.
Well, and the other thing
she
is
a fascinating self-made person. You know, she came over here when she was about 20 years old, and she had nothing. She knew nobody. She had no money. And her goal, her ambition, was to be, you know, a great columnist, a great newspaper columnist. And she comes, she works on, I think it's the New York World at first, and like within a year, she's got a solid column there looking at Broadway. And then she moves to Hollywood, knows nobody there, and goes there and becomes, I want to say, the third most influential gossip columnist. So for Scott, she was this new kind of woman. She was strong, resourceful, ambitious, smart, and she didn't need a man. Now, the way that Zelda is kind of the new woman for the late teens and early 20s in The Flapper, Sheila is sort of the new, strong, working woman for the mid-30s, well ahead of her time. And I think that was really attractive to Scott.
Mm. What's really interesting in the book is contrasting Zelda, who's institutionalized in the North Carolina mountains, and Sheila Graham, this new love for Fitzgerald. And you, the book actually opens before he leaves to go to Los Angeles. He sees her for one last time. They take a day, a drive through the hills. I found the sections with him and her to be very poignant, and especially starting the novel this way, where we see this couple that, when you think of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda, you think of this 20s flamboyant, flashy couple, and here they are a decade later, really in ruins.
Yeah, they're kind of worn down, but they have this devotion for each other. Now, even though the relationship is no longer really that of sort of a romantic husband and wife, there's a great care, I think, there. And there's a comfort when they're together there. But, of course, when they have to part, when he has to go back west, it just tears him up. And every time he leaves her, he falls off the wagon. Now, and famously, that would happen, and then Sheila would put him back together. And after a while, Sheila was like, look, I can't do this. I just cannot pick you up one more time. And she says to him, you know, I drag myself out of the gutter. You know, I'm not going back there for you.
Mm, interesting. One of the most witty parts of the book is this repartee, especially with Dorothy Parker, Robert Benchley, and the like, Humphrey Bogart and Scott, as they basically sit around and bitch and moan about the
Hollywood. Yeah. Well, I mean, for writers, it was tough because, you know, they were used to having their way. You know, their every little fix, their every little revision was seen as holy. There. Now out in Hollywood, you know, the producers are just, you know, getting rid of pages of their scripts and bringing in other writers on top of them, and they're not used to that. But they're doing it because the pay is extremely good, especially for the Depression. They're making big bucks, but they feel they're selling their souls. So the way they get around it is just bitching and moaning about it. Like Dorothy Parker. Oh, my gosh. Bitching and moaning about it the whole time, but she stayed there 10 years.
Yeah. Now, what was it like to write dialogue for somebody like Dorothy Parker? I mean, she was... And there are a number of little bon mots in this, and I don't know if they're real or imagined, and I'm not sure I even want to know.
It was great working with her, and her husband, Alan Campbell, was supposedly even funnier than she was. So to have them sort of riffing off each other, and there was Scott, who was, we forget how funny Fitzgerald was. He's a great, great comic writer. You know, we see him as a tragedian, but he's really, really funny. And of course, we know that Bogey's got this wry sense of humor. So having some of these characters in a weird way being ready-made, because we already have a feel for Dorothy Parker, what she's going to sound like, and for Bogart. We can hear Bogart's voice in our heads. So I can take that and sort of push it a little bit further there and make it a little more, I hope, a little more funny.
My guest today is Stuart Onan, a novelist and nonfiction writer. His latest novel is titled West of Sunset. It's now out in softcover. And he has a new book coming out in the spring called City of Secrets, set in 1945 British Palestine. We'll talk about that in a moment, but he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what was the biggest discovery you learned about this period of Fitzgerald's life? Because I think when most people think about Fitzgerald, they think of the 20s as his heyday and this slow decline over the 30s and his death in the end of 1940.
The strangest thing for me was just seeing how he came back. And we have the first 160 pages of The Last Tycoon, which is his unfinished novel. And those 160 pages, they're up there with Gatsby. They're gorgeous. I mean, the figurative language is there, the humor is there, the strangeness, the romance. I mean, it is subtitled A Love Story. And it definitely is. This is sort of the romantic clay about his love affair with Sheila, also tied in with his view of Irving Thalberg, the great producer who he'd worked for earlier. And just how good it is. And, you know, as a writer, you know that when the writing's going well, nothing else matters. So here he is. He's in love. The writing's going well. You know, he found himself again. He regained himself. He'd come back. Sadly, you know, his health cut that short. And he worked so hard. That was the other thing, you know, how much he got done. A lot of critics say that he went out there and he just wasted his time and he wasted his talent. But when he's out there, he's writing The Last Tycoon. He's writing the Pat Hobby stories, at least 250 pages worth of very wonderful comic stories there, plus some other stories, plus nonfiction, plus he's written at least 14 screenplays while he was out there, as well as revising other people's things. He is great friends with John O'Hara and reads his Hollywood novel, Hope of Heaven, great friends with Nathaniel West and helps him with Day of the Locust. And even now, people see the Day of the Locust and The Last Tycoon as probably the two best Hollywood novels ever written. Yeah. Scott's isn't even finished.
Well, what did he do as far as his film work? Was it mostly film doctoring, or did he? Because I don't think he had any original screenplays. Did he have credits actually?
He has one credit, and that credit is for Three Comrades, which is a novel by Eric Maria Remarque, who of course wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. So it was a very political movie at the time. It's an anti-Nazi movie,
right?
And there was a whole kerfuffle about. Some German attachés out there who were de facto censors for the Germans, and the studio heads would kowtow to them. And Scott was sort of in the middle of that. And Dorothy Parker is the head of the anti-Nazi league out there. Hemingway, of course, is, you know, a staunch supporter of the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War. So there are great expectations for him in writing that movie. How can he protect that anti-Nazi message in there from the censors and the studios? And I think he did a pretty good job of that. He didn't get another credit, although he worked on something like 17 other films. He did work on Gone with the Wind, which is another thing that sort of startled me. I had no idea. He was the ninth writer that David O. Selznick brought in to work on Sidney Howard's original script and revise it.
Perhaps
Selznick was famous for staying up all night and taking amphetamines.
Right.
I think you can still get a prescription for amphetamines in Hollywood, but Scott would pull these all-nighters with him for 2 weeks working on it. And in a section, I didn't actually include this in the book, Sheila and Scott basically acted out the staircase scene, the My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn scene. I was tempted to put that in, but I thought, I don't really need it to do what I need to do here.
Yeah. Now you mentioned the Pat Hobby stories. I wonder how much of an influence they were on his thinking about where he was in Hollywood, because Pat Hobby, the Pat Hobby stories, for those that don't know it, a series of stories that were first published in Esquire, then later became in a book form. They're these short stories about a down on his luck screenwriter, writer and screenwriter, and it's just exposing all the foibles of Hollywood. What influence were those stories on you as you're putting this book together?
Seeing Scott write about Pat Hobby, this broken-down hack screenwriter who he's always hustling. He's always hustling to try to make a buck to pay for his ex-wife and all this. How objective Scott could be about his own situation and then turn that into moving fiction and comedic fiction as well. I mean, we think of Scott's time there as, this horrible tragedy and he's suffering, blah, blah, blah. And here he is writing jokes about it. And his Pat Hobby story about Orson Welles is priceless, just brilliant, spectacularly funny. I think he always had this capability. You look at him writing about his own life, you'd say, in Tender as the Night, in a heartbreaking fashion, or even, say, in The Great Gatsby, since he and Zelda have just gone through sort of this marital implosion after she's had this affair with Jovan, the French aviator. In Gatsby, of course, we have this great scene where Gatsby wants Daisy to say that she never loved Tom there. That scene, Zelda and Scott, after he's written that scene, Zelda and Scott together are revising Gatsby for publication.
Wow.
After having gone through that same scene in real life, which is an amazing job of sort of objectifying experience and then bringing it back.
Well, it's a really interesting book. The name of the book is West of Sunset. My guest today is Stuart Onan, a novelist and nonfiction writer. And one of the things that's really amazing is, one, is you're putting out a book every couple of years, and you're moving back and forth between nonfiction and fiction. What is the connection there? Do you work in fiction for a while and then say, okay, I want to write a nonfiction story, or what exactly?
No, I'm more of a novelist, I think. I think, most of my books are novels.
True.
Even if they have some sort of nonfiction component to them or real-life component to them. I read lots of books, and I love all kinds of different books. So it seems natural that I would write all different kinds of books, because reading, I think, is the spur for writing. Saul Bellow says, a writer is just a reader who's moved to emulation. I think that's true, because I didn't start as a writer. I started as an engineer, but I've always been a big, big reader.
And I guess your first literature teaching job was here in Oklahoma.
University of Central Oklahoma, yes, indeed. Go Huskies. And the people there were just so welcoming and helpful. And I was writing this big, long Vietnam novel at the time called The Names of the Dead. And I did not know, but Oklahoma has this wonderful tradition of people coming from the military, retiring, and then joining administrative positions within the university system. And so there were some Vietnam veterans in the administration there at UCO that really helped me with that book. And I owe them a great, great debt because, I know very little about Vietnam and they know everything.
Yeah. Now, this book and the next book are two of a kind in a way in which you're really inhabiting a world that occurred many years ago. Obviously, West of Sunset is Hollywood in the pre-war years. Your next book is going to be set in right after the war in 1945, British Palestine. What was it like to inhabit that particular world?
Yeah, Jerusalem and the Old City, very different, very, very different. But I've always had a great love for that era and that sort of that post-war period where the world is trying to figure out what it's going to be like. That's the world I grew up in the 1960s, was formed by World War II and the fallout from World War II. And nowhere was the issue more in question than in the Middle East. The British had been there since 1918 after defeating the Ottoman Turks. And this is the rise of the Jewish underground fighting the British mandate there. And the Arabs are kind of off to the side, not quite knowing what to do. They don't have the political power. They have not banded together at this point. So it's a novel about political violence. It's a novel about faith and identity and last things. It's very much in the mode of a Graham Greene. I think of it the way that I think of, say, The Quiet American, the Saigon of A Quiet American, or the Vienna of The Third Man. Also, Joseph Conrad, the secret agent, which looks at, you know, what are the roots of political violence. In that case, anarchism. But in this case, there's definitely a cause, and the question is, how do you inflict political violence on a semi-civilian population or soft target after it has just been inflicted upon you? Because a lot of the people in the Irgun were survivors of the death camps.
Right.
And it seems a paradox, and yet the more and more that I wrote about it, it seemed, how could you not? That's simply how it happened. The abuser, you know, the abused becomes the abuser.
How much of what's happening today has informed this, as far as deciding to write about this?
You know, I think you can draw a parallel to it, but you probably could at any time in that history from 1945 onward. There, it's just, I don't know. It's that question of, you know, what are we going to do to ensure that we can have self-governance? And that's a question that, you know, is asked across the globe and always has been, always will be. It's certainly a strangely American question. We think of the American Revolution, the idea of what are we willing to do to make sure that we can govern ourselves?
Mm. Well, that next book, City of Secrets, it's, I guess, due out in April, is that right?
April, yes, indeed, from Viking.
Well, The West of Sunset is really a wonderful read. I love the repartee between all of the various characters as they're gathering around for drinks in the evening. And these wonderful locations, whether it be the Coconut Grove or the Garden of Allah Hotel. And I assume you had to do a little bit of research to what those places were like.
Ton of research, but luckily there's lots of pictures from back in the day, and there's also a lot of film because Hollywood, of course, loved to promote the Hollywood lifestyle. So there's all sorts of film of them, you know, eating at the Brown Derby and, you know, going to the Trocadero, and like you say, you know, at the Ambassador Hotel where some of the first Academy Awards were held. So I got to go back and look at all the back lot at MGM, which is long gone now. But there's some wonderful books that show all the different fake streets there that Scott and Sheila, you know, walked up and down during their lunch hours. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's just a romantic, great romantic time. And I wanted to make sure that I got that in there. It's, you know, not the sadness, but it's, you know, it's the dancing, it's the music, you know, it's the, you know, the late nights, the Hollywood Hills. And, you know, in that era, we don't think of it now, but L.A. really is a beautiful, beautiful city. It's gorgeous, striking views. You have the mountains there running right down to the sea. And, you know, for one long season, one very beautiful season in his life, he lived in Malibu. And he loved it. Being this guy from St. Paul, you know, he's used to sort of the hard, bitten, cold winters. Here he is having Christmas at Malibu with his, you know, his new love.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful book, West of Sunset. And we look forward to City of Secrets coming out later this year. And, you know, as I look at your output, I mean, you're putting out a book about every other year, it seems like.
Well, thank you. And I've started another one. I started a new one. And, you know, it's just underway. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. A little early to tell.
All right. Well, Stuart Onan, appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Novelist Stuart Onan speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His retelling of the last years of F. Scott Fitzgerald, his latest novel, is titled West of Sunset, and it's now available in paperback from Penguin. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
This is a story about old men and driving. If you're pressed for time, let me cut to the chase. Don't take away their license. Recently, my father lost his wallet, which necessitated him getting a new driver's license, an Oklahoma driver's license. He came from Las Vegas, but refused to get a new license here because he was worried the state would make him take a driving test, which he knew he would fail, and or a written test, which he feared he would fail. I'm not taking a test. I've been driving for 70 years. The state's going to tell me I can't drive? Actually, Dad, that's exactly who would tell you that. They're not taking my license. You're not. I need wheels, and I'm not taking a test. If they make me take one and I fail, I'll make my own. I'll just make one up and photocopy it. That's all. Yeah, what could go wrong there? I mean, what could possibly go wrong with a handmade license from a man who doesn't know how to change the cartridge on his Lexmark? As it turns out, When I went to the Department of Public Safety, aptly named, my father had to take neither a written nor driving test, but did have to take a vision test. He wears prescription glasses for both reading and driving, but prefers the glasses at the dollar store for reasons that defy understanding, and has, at last count, 23 pairs around the house. They're stacked in pencil holders, kitchen drawers, even the bathroom sink. For emergencies, he tells me. During the test, which required him to look into a cone of sorts, I noticed the man giving the exam kept pushing buttons to make the text bigger. "Now, sir? Now?" the clerk kept asking. "I'm not seeing a thing," my father screamed. "This stupid machine. The letters keep moving around." Somehow, my father got a license anyway. I knew two things as we left. One, I was driving home. Two, he was getting his eyes checked. "I don't want to go to an eye doctor. What's he going to tell me I can't see?" "Yeah, again, Dad, that's pretty much who would tell you that. I can see fine. It's these damn roads in Oklahoma that's the problem." More on that in a moment. The medical diagnosis. "Well, Jack," the doctor said, "your left eye, your right eye is terrible. Really a mess." Translation. My father has 20/45 vision in his left eye, has 20/400 vision in his right. Terrible, right? "Things are a little blurry in that eye," he told the doctor, "but I can see. If you pave these damn roads of yours, come on, the federal government gives you the money." The doctor looked at me. He had kind of a help me look. I could do him no good. That was my father's explanation, by the way, for the accident he had a week after arriving here when he plowed into someone making a left-hand turn. An accident, he swears, would never have happened in Las Vegas because apparently nobody there makes left-hand turns, and where, more importantly, they use the money the feds give them. The doctor explained to my father his cataracts are like ice over a windshield and recommended surgery. "Ah, come on," my father said. "How much longer have I got to live?" Yeah, he went there. So how, I wondered, was my father able to get a license? The ophthalmologist smiled. And why did he smile? Let me read it to you. This from the law. "An applicant may be considered for a license if visual acuity is 20/60 or better with or without corrective lenses, or 20/50 or better in one eye with or without corrective lenses." One eye! Wait, it gets worse. "Individuals who cannot meet the acuity requirements may apply for a restricted license, speed limit, locale, time, if the visual acuity is no worse than 20/100 in one eye or both eyes with or without corrective lenses." Lovely. A defiant 88-year-old man with 20/100 vision in one eye, effectively blind in the other, with no depth perception, can still get a waiver in Oklahoma to drive, say, to the dollar store to buy another pair of glasses, which will do him no good. Just think about that the next time you're making a left. And remember, old men and licenses, do not take them away. They'll just make their own anyway.
Barry Friedman is a writer, a stand-up comic, and a columnist for the Tulsa Voice. He's a regular contributor as well to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.